This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. Imagine being woken up in the middle of the night by strangers who force you from your bed as your parents watch from the door. They won't tell you where you're going until you arrive. Your destination, one of America's behavioral treatment programs for wayward teens. Tens of thousands of desperate parents who feel they've run out of options turn to the so-called troubled teen industry every year to get their kids back on track. People like Jennifer, who emailed, "I am a psychologist and the parent of a college student who went to a wilderness program and then a residential treatment center 3 years ago. These programs saved my daughter's life. My daughter struggled with substance abuse, self-harm, anxiety, and depression before she went away, in part due to an undisclosed history of sexual assault. She was able to work through her trauma, learn skills for managing her emotions, finish high school, and apply to college during her time away." But some former students say the programs did more harm than good.
We found a solid program that literally saved our kiddo's life, and our kiddo is also the first person to say that they would be dead right now if we hadn't sent them to Utah.
I think through everything, the aspects of these programs that have had the longest lasting effect on me were the loss of autonomy, self-identity, and the gaslighting.
My son says it was the best experience of his life. His therapist understood him and us like no one else ever has.
After I graduated, and years later, I was diagnosed with complex post-traumatic stress disorder, panic disorder, and more. It affected my life and my relationships to this day.
We talked to a survivor turned advocate whose name you'll recognize, Paris Hilton, and that conversation will come shortly. But first, my guests for the hour. Kenneth Rosen is a senior editor and correspondent at Newsweek. He's also the author of Troubled, The Failed Promise of America's Behavioral Treatment Programs. Ken, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jen. Great to be here.
Also here is the executive director of the National Association of Therapeutic Schools and Programs, also known as NATSAP, Megan Stokes. Megan, welcome to 1A.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
So, Ken, can you give us an overview of America's behavioral treatment programs? Because there are public pay and private pay programs under that umbrella, as well as residential and wilderness programs.
Right. Generally speaking, they're what is known as congregate care, and they take children who are on a troubled streak or having difficulties at home or in school and place them in any number of residential facilities and also wilderness programs. Generally speaking, there's a track that many of the teens take. It goes from a wilderness therapy program, which leads to a residential therapeutic boarding school or a similar environment, and then later a residential treatment center at some points. Sometimes this third school isn't necessary, but it's a track that I've seen time and again in the reporting of my book. They are across the country in many different states, and generally speaking, a lot of families end up sending their child out of state to one of several programs in a more less populous state, such as Utah or Idaho, where they are sought care for these numerous different ailments, whether it be anxiety disorders or depression or substance abuse or, in some cases, sexual deviance.
Now, your story, which, because you have a personal connection to this, it begins in 2007. You were a teenager, and you look back on that night as a kidnapping. Can you describe what happened?
Yeah, you described it pretty well in the beginning of the show. Two men came into my room in the middle of the night while I was asleep and took me from my bed. Sort of a random event that later struck me as an extreme answer to the problems I was having back home. But at any rate, they transported me 9 hours north from my home in New Jersey to a wilderness program in the Adirondack Mountains of upstate New York, where I would spend roughly 60 to 70 days before starting a journey that lasted the better part of a year through several of these types of programs.
And what was your understanding of why you were being sent to this program?
There was no real clear understanding at the outset. I knew that I had been difficult. I knew that I wasn't going to school, and I knew that I was driving my mother up a wall. That goes without saying. But I didn't understand the sort of response of these men coming in my room, of being taken so far from home, of being forced into treatment. I understood loosely, again, this sort of boot camp, redirection therapy, scared straight type of program just from murmurs around high school and friends and obviously pop culture, but I didn't really know it in full definition until I arrived in upstate New York.
Well, let's hear another message we received. This one is from Cami in San Francisco, who says her parents sent her away in the late 90s at 16 for smoking pot.
When I try to explain the program to people, I find myself telling them about the physically abusive stuff, because that's what people understand. But those were actually the easiest parts of the program for me. The worst parts were that they encouraged us to be cruel to each other. I think it still messes with my ability to connect with and trust other humans. We had to use our knowledge of each other's most shameful secrets to hurt each other. Because if you didn't give harsh feedback, you couldn't get points. And if you didn't get points, you couldn't move up in the levels. And if you didn't move up in the levels, you would never get to go home.
Megan, as the head of the National Association of Therapeutic Schools and Programs, you represent this industry that's coming under fire. I'd love to hear your response.
Absolutely. So I know you're going to be mentioning Paris Hilton and her documentary later on in the program, but I did read Kenneth's book. I listened to the stories of the survivors. I want to use the terminology that they use, and it's heartbreaking. That's not what we want. It's not therapeutic. It is one of those where we would like there to be these options, these residential treatment centers, where they're trauma-informed, where they provide support and the resources and tools that a person can use as they are struggling with their mental illness and trauma they might have received at a younger age, and that they can move forward with their lives to be successful in their own way.
Ken, what did you experience at these programs and in the aftermath that made you want to cover this story?
Well, at first, I didn't really think it affected me. For a really long time, I had left the programs and believed myself to be scot-free. The trouble came a lot later, and I always chalked it up to that early streak of troubled youth, which is sort of the brilliance of these programs, is that they implant this identity of someone who's forever to be troubled unless they follow these directives. So when I took about, when I underwent reporting this book, I went and revisited a lot of my former classmates and people I attended these programs with and the survivors of these programs to learn that a lot of them were struggling into adulthood, and a lot of them could draw a connection and a parallel to their time at a residential treatment center, at a wilderness program, or just by and large being taken in the middle of the night. I think the clip you played is a really, really outstanding example of how the manipulation is sort of subtle, this idea of ratting out your fellow students, your other clients in these programs in order to benefit yourself really does affect someone who's then asked to return to society. And it doesn't help really the emotional growth or the familial relationships that are important to success on returning home to have the parents told that anything your child reports to you, anything that they say during the program that sounds like they're being abused or they're being neglected is a falsehood. Don't believe them. They're manipulating you.
Megan, what kind of oversight is there over behavioral treatment programs? Is there an accreditation system with certain requirements that people have to meet in order to work there?
So, good question. Every state will have their own licensing or lack thereof. Some states do not have licensing for programs. So they'll have their own licensing, and those licensors can come onto your campus, meet with students, go through records, check for safety, et cetera. There's also several accrediting bodies. You have the Joint Commission, you have the Council on Accreditation, COA, and you have CARF, which I always blank on what that acronym stands for, but it's another really great accrediting body. And they act very similar to licensing in that they can go on site, talk to the students, review records, but they also have their own standards that facilities must meet before they can be Joint Commission accredited, for example.
Ken, is that part of the issue, that there is a state-by-state approach to standardization of these programs and there's not federal oversight?
In large part, Jen, I think that we need a sort of federal floor of regulations and oversight in order to build more robust state policy. But I think that in large part, the organizations that are calling themselves accrediting bodies or that are associations that partner with the programs in order to market a sort of alternative treatment to children are really not taking the most honest approach to how they're representing the programs. And we hear that sometimes they're accredited at the beginning, that they're led into the programs to sort of vet any of the clientele or the counselors, but that really doesn't happen throughout. I mean, most recently we saw NATSAP say to programs in Utah to really be standoffish when it comes to an investigating body looking to understand things that were going on at the program, to understand allegations of abuse.
I want to get to a response from you to that, Megan, after the break. But we've been getting just an overwhelming number of messages from people with experiences with behavioral residential programs. Emma emailed, I was sent to a residential treatment center in Utah when I was 16 and lived there for a year. It was the best possible thing my parents could have done for me. I won't say it was a perfect experience. There was definitely room for improvement. The staff were young and made mistakes, but on the whole, it was a helpful place. I learned how to live with integrity and to be kind myself. I am now 32, and I look back on that treatment center with gratitude. It truly turned my life around. But Robin sent us this email saying, sending my child for treatment with the troubled teen industry for nearly 2 years is both the regret and the relief of my life. I regret that I was unable to give him what he needed here at home. I am relieved that he survived his addiction and avoided the U.S. criminal justice system. He's doing well today. We are all building back as a family. We're talking to Kenneth Rosen, journalist and author of Trouble, The Failed Promise of America's Behavioral Treatment Programs, and Megan Stokes, executive director of the National Association of Therapeutic Schools and Programs. Up next, we'll hear from Paris Hilton about her experience at one of America's behavioral treatment programs and why she's using her platform to speak up. I'm Jen White. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR. I'm Jen White. This is 1A. Tens of thousands of parents across the country spend millions of dollars to send their misbehaving teens to behavioral treatment programs that promise to get the kids back on track. While it works for some, others reflect on it differently.
My parents sent me to a lockdown facility because it claimed it could cure my depression, not because my life was in danger. These programs do not admit students based on what is medically necessary. Their profits rely on convincing parents they are the only cure. My parents loved me so much, and by trying to help me, they subjected me to trauma I will spend the rest of my life overcoming.
I was left with extreme shame and confusion around my sexual orientation and gender identity. I'm 32, and I've never had a first date.
They let staff with perhaps hours of training instigate, taunt, make fun of, physically harm students. There wasn't any attempt at warmth, compassion, connection, just compliance and order. It was just like one long episode of Orange is the New Black.
Really, they aimed to break us down so that they could build us back up as they saw fit. We've been purposefully scared into silence and taught no one would believe us. I know for me, at least, hearing so many other stories so similar to mine has given me the courage to begin speaking up.
Someone else who recently got the courage to begin speaking up may come as a surprise. Lifestyle it girl, Paris Hilton. She first told her story in her new documentary released last year, This is Paris. Now she's an advocate with the organization Breaking Code Silence for the closure of the Utah school where she was sent, Provo Canyon School. I spoke to her late last week and began by asking her how her years attending residential treatment programs began.
The first place I went to was CDU, which is now shut down because of all the abuse. I ran away from there, and then I was sent to Ascent, which is a wilderness program, which is in Idaho. And I ran away from there, and then I was sent to Cascade, which is another one of these schools, which is in Redding, California. And after running away from there, the last place I went to was Provo Canyon School, because there's no escaping from that place. I had all of my human rights taken away. I was cut off from the outside world. Myself and other children being restrained. They would prescribe medication. It wasn't even a doctor who would prescribe it. They would just, it almost seemed like they were like experimenting on us, all of these new types of medications. I found out a way where I would just hide them under my tongue and pretend that I took them and just put them into like a Kleenex and hide them in my room. And then one day they found out that I was doing that because one of the students found them and told on me. And I was taken into solitary confinement. I don't even know how long I was in there. I think over 48 hours with no food, no one speaking to me. And it was just miserable.
When you were in these places and experiencing these things, how was it explained to you? What were you told about why you were there, what they were trying to do? I'm just trying to wrap my head around what you were being told.
They didn't really explain anything. You weren't allowed to talk back. You weren't allowed to ask questions. It was all about just being silent and following whatever they said. And the people that worked there were all unqualified. All you had to do to be able to work there was to be 21 and to either have a high school diploma or a GED. So none of these people had any training, so they had no idea what they were doing. It was almost like it really attracted people that were predators and pedophiles and people who really enjoyed the power trip and abusing children. So I was never really explained anything. I just was almost like they would just purposely do things to break you down, and that was the whole point of it. You know, I didn't deserve to be there. I was just a 16-year-old girl. I got bad grades in school. I was ditching class, and that was about it. I'd never gotten in trouble in my life before that. But there's these therapists that are all around the world that get kickbacks and are paid by these schools to send children there.
When you think about the long-term impact your time at Provo Canyon School and these other facilities had on your life, and when you talk to other people who have had similar experiences, what's the range of impact that you see?
It's just been incredible. You know, when my documentary, This Is Paris, first came out, I was terrified of what the world was going to think. You know, the premise of it was never supposed to be about that. I just really wanted to do a movie just to show about who I was and the businesswoman I am and everything that I've accomplished and just all the misconceptions about me. I just wanted to show the world that that wasn't really me. And I just became so close with the director where I felt like I could open up to her about anything. And as soon as the film was released, it was just this outpour of love and support and getting thousands of letters a day from survivors who have been through the same thing as me and connecting with people who I was at these places with and everyone just saying, thank you so much. Like, you've validated me. No one has ever believed me. Like, I haven't spoken to my parents in 20 years. And because of this film, my parents now believe me and we finally have a relationship again. And then other parents have contacted me that after watching the film, that they went to Provo Canyon and to other schools to pick up their children. And I just spoke to a girl last week who just got pulled out of there a month ago at Provo. And she said, Paris, like, you have no idea, like all the kids there, you should be so proud. Everyone's talking about you. It's just been so empowering to actually have made a difference. And I feel that now that I really have a real mission in life, and I'm dedicating my life to do this and to really just put a stop to this.
The documentary has animations of nightmares you still have related to your time in these schools. And I wonder, since you've spoken out, has there been any shift for you in how you've been able to process these experiences?
Yes, I used to have... I don't as much anymore, but before I spoke about this, I had severe nightmares. Every single night, it would be the same nightmare with the two men coming into my room, taking me, and then being locked up in one of these places and just trying to escape and do anything I could to get out of there. And having to hold that all in and not talk about it with anyone ever until now. And I feel that because I held it in, that was the reason that my body, my mind kept going back to that. And ever since I've spoken about it and released it, the nightmares have almost stopped. Like sometimes I will, when I am like, when I'm doing these things or talking about it, sometimes that night I will have a dream about it, but it's not as severe as before. And I really do believe if you are going through something traumatic in your life, if you actually speak about it and let it out, that you can heal from that.
What would you say to parents who feel desperate? They feel like they've run out of options. They feel these programs are the only thing they can do to save their child.
I would say that there is so many other options, and do not send your children to these places. It's going to give your child more issues than they went in with, more issues that you could ever even imagine. These places are not regulated. They have these fake brochures that show this happy place, that horses and sports and going outside, and it's nothing like what they advertise at all. There's other ways. So my advice is really, really do your research, because, you know, back then we didn't have all of this with the internet and, you know, people being able to be on social media and tell the real story. And now we have that technology where you can find out anything and you can do that research. You know, I'm hoping with this that there people are going to finally be held accountable, and there will be programs that open up that are, you know, going to help and are real emotional growth schools where it's actually going to make a difference. But from the places I've seen so far, that's not happening yet.
And for you and your parents, have you been able to talk about this now that you've opened up and shared your story?
The first time I even spoke to my mother about it was during the filming of my documentary. And my mom was just in shock because she had no idea. And it was something that, you know, as a teenager, I was obviously very upset and mad at her. But after realizing and talking to so many other people and so many parents that I totally understand, because she was lied to and she had no idea, and neither did my father. And I don't blame them anymore, because I know that these places manipulated them and lied to them, and they were just doing what they thought was best, and they thought it was normal boarding school. You know, it was many, many years till I actually spoke about it with them, but I'm grateful that I have. And now my parents have been so supportive with me and with all the survivors, and my mom has been on Breaking Code Silence and talking to other survivors and just other parents. And I think it's very healing for both the child and the parent to do that, because otherwise you just have so many just unresolved issues.
You said you feel like you have purpose, a purpose in life now. And I wonder what it is like for you that this is the purpose, that this is the thing you're dedicating your life, your voice, and your platform to.
You know, before this, I created this character and this fantasy life because I wanted to pretend that everything was perfect. You know, it was kind of based on like some shallow just purposes in life. It was always about fashion or like whatever, just things that are like monetary and just things that are materialistic. And now I just feel that that's not what I want to be. I feel that God really just, I think he gave me this special gift and made me go through that, because he knew that one day that I would use my voice and my platform to make a difference and to be able to not only save children that are in there now, but from future children having to go through what myself and so many others have, is such an empowering feeling. And I am just so proud. And I know that me, when I was a little girl in there, would be so proud of the woman that I am today.
Paris Hilton, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Now let's turn back to our panelists. Megan Stokes is the Executive Director of the National Association of Therapeutic Schools and Programs, and Kenneth Rosen is a journalist and author of Troubled, The Failed Promise of America's Behavioral Treatment Programs. We also want to hear from you. You can comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or send us an email at 1A@WAMU.org. Megan, I'd love to turn to you and give you a chance to respond to what you just heard from Para. She's very critical of your industry.
Thank you, Jen. Yeah, I actually want to quickly go back to Kenneth's point. Earlier in the show, he brought up this call, and I want to kind of fill in some history here for the listeners. So every state has a protection and advocacy system. They're charged with protecting those who have disabilities, and their role is to be an advocate. They can help those with disabilities find employment, housing, make sure they have the receiving the right support at school, access to voting. They also have the role of investigating possible abuse and neglect that might occur at public facilities, private facilities, schools, individual homes. They're known as either the Disability Law Center or Disability Rights, and then whatever state's name, Disability Rights Maryland, for example. Well, the Protection Advocacy Group in Utah, which is known as the Utah Disability Law Center, or the DLC, they announced that they were going to be investigating all treatment programs in Utah, and they had started requesting records from the state for all these programs. I had a call in October with my members to let them know about who the DLC were, why they were created, what happens when they show up on a campus, et cetera. The call was leaked to Breaking Code Silence, and the full call was cut to a 3-minute video that lost a lot of the context. But I do want to state that I stand by the idea that it's a best practice to have a lawyer review any request from a third party who is seeking to access your records or the clients in your care. I definitely want to say that I appreciate that Breaking Code Silence kept in the part where I asked that NATSAP membership be polite to the employees of the DLC. Because if someone shows up on your campus and says, I'm with the Disability Law Center, and you're not familiar with them, you're not going to assume that they have the support of the federal government to have oversight. You're going to assume they might be just a private group or a nonprofit. And so we wanted to provide that information.
You said that they're required to investigate abuse, but that means abuse has to be reported. How concerned are you about people like Paris, who went much of their adult lives not talking about what they experienced? It seems like there's a possibility of there are lots of people falling in the cracks.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think with the advent of Breaking Code Silence and then Paris Hilton coming out with her documentary and then Kenneth coming out with his book, you're going to have those people who might feel more comfortable talking about it. I think when Paris first left her Provo Canyon, there wasn't the access to the internet and social media and the spaces that have been created for people who have gone to programs. Some of them are like private Facebook groups, Instagram circles, etc. These exist now. So there might be a little more camaraderie, but also there might be a little bit more to process for those who had a poor experience.
And I also, because we have just about a minute and a half here, do you agree with Ken that there needs to be a basic federal threshold for oversight and accreditation of these centers that states can then build on?
Yes, I do think that's probably going to be coming down the pipe. There was a couple of bills introduced on the federal level, starting with Representative George Miller from California. He has since retired. Representative Adam Schiff has taken up that mantle over the last couple of sessions. He did not introduce it last session, but he was a little busy. But so that might be something that'll be coming down the pipe eventually. I also know we recently had the Family First legislation that was passed regarding public pay programs and defining what a qualified residential treatment facility was, and that might be part of that as well.
We're talking about the behavioral treatment program some parents turn to when they feel they've run out of options. Our guests are journalist and author Kenneth Rosen and Megan Stokes of the National Association of Therapeutic Schools and Programs. We're also hearing from you. Amanda tweeted, I was at a residential treatment program in Connecticut in 2006 through 2007. Though it did make me more resilient in terms of day-to-day functioning, I really lost my sense of self there. The head therapist had previously been a Catholic priest and somehow couldn't be objective. Yes, it's fair to say that cutting yourself to get attention when you're sad is a bad idea, but there's no need to shame people about things like having non-traditional sexual identities or using social media. And Matt sent us this email. I had undiagnosed autism and was in a place that mocked me, demanded I socialize more than I could, and diagnosed me as mentally ill. There are no words to describe the loss I have incurred as a result. It was long ago, and only now do I feel that at least I know who I am, autistic and not intrinsically broken. If only I had known, my life would be different. I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and our guests in just a moment. We're talking about America's behavioral and residential treatment programs, where thousands of wayward teens are sent every year by parents who are desperate to get their kids back on track. But allegations of abuse at those programs abound, starting with how kids get to them. Here's a message that came to us from Natalie.
It was the running away from home that became the reason I got sent and agreed to meet my parents for therapy with a therapist I'd never met in my life, wasn't even asked to take a drug test, and was immediately handcuffed by two very large escorts who threatened me and told me they were the judo champions of America and that I would get hurt if I tried to run away. And after that, I was essentially treated like a criminal.
Thanks for sharing that with us, Natalie. Our guests for the hour are the Executive Director of the National Association of Therapeutic Schools and Programs, Megan Stokes, and journalist Kenneth Rosen. His new book is Troubled, The Failed Promise of America's Behavioral Treatment Programs. And let's bring another voice into the conversation. Joining us now is Oregon Democratic State Senator Sarah Gelser, who has taken this issue up in her home state. Senator Gelser, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me and talking about this important issue.
So let's start with what we just heard from Natalie about how traumatizing they found their transport to their programs. How are you addressing that issue in Oregon?
We do have legislation this session that will regulate the transport agencies for the first time. It will subject them to rigorous restrictions around the use of restraints. It will ban the use of blindfolds and handcuffs and really start to apply to these individuals policies that say you cannot alarm a child. It is simply wrong to kidnap a child in the middle of the night. When I talk to these survivors, often, as bad as the programs are, the thing that is the hardest to get over is that sense of being torn from your bed in front of your parents in the place that you are supposed to be safest. People really struggle to recover from that.
Now, Oregon has also passed reform on the use of restraints, but you're hoping to take that reform even further this year. Tell us about that.
Yes, I introduced legislation last Friday that will offer more clarity about what is not allowed in terms of a restraint, specifically impeding breathing, putting hands on a neck or a mouth, multiple people piling on top of a child, supine and prone restraints that have killed children, including Cornelius Frederick this year. And we'll be more clear about what is required in terms of training, only allowing those that hold an actual certification that they have earned by demonstrating proficiency, both written and technical, before they are allowed to apply those restraints.
So, Ken, that's the picture in Oregon. Give us a nationwide picture. Are legislators attempting to reform this industry in other states or on the federal level? How much momentum is there right now?
Well, certainly, George.
I'm sorry, Ken.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, is it me?
Yeah, Ken, go ahead.
Yeah, there isn't much momentum that I've noticed. I think that there has been years of legislative deadlock in trying to get bills passed, the same types of bills that Senator Gelser is really working to push forward. The problem is the lobby of the industry is so strong, and I'm really happy to have heard Ms. Stokes' take earlier on what was going on in Utah, because it's these thinly veiled innuendos that the children persist as problems, that the programs aren't necessarily the cause of the issues, that are really perpetuating a counter-narrative that's doing more harm to the kids and also to the exposure of these programs. It's continually put back on the children as, you know, they were offered an opportunity to report, they weren't able to, or the programs encourage parents and officials to not listen to the children because they're troubled, because they're going to issue predictable complaints, negotiations, and manipulations that have been primed as an example of a troubled youth. So even when we do get to the point of legislation, I fear that the industry, the associations who are ad hoc accrediting bodies are going to continue to push their narrative that anyone who's in these programs is already a lost cause and we're doing our best. But despite the congregate care, which we know does not work, they're just not working out.
Well, and I think this brings up a broader question about the efficacy of these programs. And I'd like to hear from all of you on this. What evidence or research do we have about how well these behavioral treatment programs actually work, especially compared to other options? Senator, I'll come to you first.
Sure. The research clearly shows that congregate care does not work for children. The long-term outcomes for kids in congregate care are poor compared to kids that stay at home or kids that go into evidence-based therapeutic foster care. The answer to this is not to say that kids and families don't have needs that need to be met. They do, but we need to deliver those services to families and kids together in their homes or in their communities. Sending kids far away from everyone they know and everything they know to be with strangers, to be broken down, to be separated from their entire lives does nothing but cause harm.
Megan?
Sorry, I was trying to non-mute myself. So we have actually worked with the University of New Hampshire over the past several years on creating this outcomes research database because of the fact that we wanted to see what else was out there in terms of the effectiveness of programs, the safety of programs. We use the, not everyone, but most programs use the Youth Outcomes Questionnaire. It's received an A rating from the California Evidence-Based Clearinghouse for Child Welfare. For the adults, there's the Outcomes Questionnaire 45.2, which is commonly used. These are self-reported surveys, so self-assessments. For the adolescents, the parents or guardians are also provided their surveys to do assessments as well. The data is owned by individual programs, and then many programs hire a third party to help collect the data. It's scrubbed of identifying information and sent over to the researchers at the University of New Hampshire on an annual basis.
And what does that research actually show?
Sure. So when looking at the YOQ, we are showing that when a student first arrives at a program, they are, make sure I get the exact numbers for you, measuring at, I have the slowest computer in the world, but they're showing they're coming in very clinically dysregulated. When you look at the discharge, everyone, not just the adolescent, but the both parents, any guardians, anyone who might have been filling out those surveys as well, are at a lower level, much more calmer, things are being managed, symptoms are being addressed, underlying issues have been addressed. And then we also look at 6 months out and 12 months out. For some of the wilderness programs, they have data that goes back 5+ years. But we're looking at, for the YOQ, looking at the 6 month, 12 month.
And Kim, what have you found in your reporting around this question of research and efficacy?
Sure. Forgoing the notion that the industry funds the University of New Hampshire and all these studies that they promulgate, and that the fact that they only stop after six or 12 months, the issue stems from what the senator had mentioned about congregate care. Through no fault of the parents are they choosing these programs. They are made to believe that these programs are the only options for their children, and it's just not true. When you send a child with issues with depression, issues with anxiety, into a program that is also seeking to cater to someone who might be on the spectrum, who is dealing with post-traumatic stress, all looped together into one group, it's going to be detrimental, period. And that's been shown time and again to be the most adverse way of treating any type of psychological disorder. I'm not saying that a parent is wrong for having a difficult time with their child, or that the child was necessarily simple or easy to deal with. In the course of reporting my book, I found that not to be true. Many of us were difficult, but we didn't need to be tossed into a grab bag of therapeutic treatments that were, again, not evidence-based. We don't have insurance willing to cover these programs, in large part because they're not evidence-based. So there are more community-based efforts. There are more at-home, familial-based programs and treatment options that families can seek out in lieu of these programs. And I think that would be the best option for most people in a troubled situation.
We're talking to author and journalist Kenneth Rosen, executive director of the National Association of Therapeutic Schools and Programs, Megan Stokes, and Oregon State Senator Sarah Gelser, a Democrat. Senator, I wonder if this points to a larger issue about the lack of access to the kinds of mental health support young people and families need.
I think it points to two things. Yes, our mental and behavioral health system is not effective any place in the country. It is too difficult for people to access the services they need before they get into crisis. That is something that we can fix. Right now, though, we pour all of these resources into this alternative industry that isn't based on treatment. Many of these programs, their counselors, the requirements are high school diploma or GED accepted. They are not, as you know, Ken said, evidence-based. And the regulations are so poor and spotty across the country. I know that Megan mentioned, for instance, the Joint Commission as being a high quality seal of approval. I've learned firsthand that that is not true. The Joint Commission will grant accreditation to an organization even when immediate jeopardy that says all kids there are at immediate risk of serious injury or death is in place. That too is an industry-funded standard that is not based on what works well for kids. At the end of the day, congregate care is about control. Behavioral health, mental health is supposed to be about healing and support. Any program that is focused on control, breaking someone down, holding them to the ground when they don't comply, is not therapeutic. And the behaviors and controls that you see when kids leave are because they are too terrified to step out of line. They just want to get out of there. They will do whatever it takes to escape the nightmare they're living in these programs.
Well, we got a lot of messages from you, and we heard from a few parents, quite a few, who reached out to us with positive reviews of the programs they sent their children to.
I sent my son to Wilderness when he was 16.
This is a kiddo who first attempted suicide at age 11, and then between the ages of 11 and 17, probably attempted 6 or 7 more times.
He was failing school, using drugs, sneaking out of the house. We had a horrible relationship.
I should also add that this was by far the hardest decision my husband and I had ever made in our lives, and it came from a place of despair and desolation and certainty that we were going to lose our child.
There was a strong parent component to the program, and my husband and I spent about an hour a day doing our own homework, and our whole family grew so much. It was nothing but a loving and transformative experience.
There was not ever a hint of abuse. The communication was open and solid and uncensored.
When we went to pick him up, my son didn't want to leave.
So some positive experiences of families there. But Ken, a lawsuit was also filed in December against Sequel Youth and Family Services by the family of a boy who was allegedly assaulted at one of their programs. And that comes after the death last year of a different 16-year-old boy at a Sequel facility in Michigan after he was improperly restrained. Now, Sequel operates in 20 states. It makes tens of millions of dollars in profit every year. So let's talk about accountability. Has there been any?
Unfortunately, not that I've seen. There's a deafening silence on the part of the programs. We see time and again that parents are willing to come out with stories of success with their children, but we've consistently ignored the stories that lead to these deaths at these programs. It's hard to imagine that when a child is taken from their bed in the middle of the night and forced into therapy, that is the best way for them to enter any form of reformation, right? We've seen that with NA and AA, that the best way to change a behavior, to overcome an addiction, is to go willingly, right? So if that's the way we're introducing children into therapy, it's just not going to work. But to address the part of oversight or any sort of retaliation, I guess, the legal retaliation for these deaths, there's been a silence. And it's usually because we're more willing to hear out the survivors for a brief period of time, say they are outliers, and then let the dust settle and go on to funding these programs. And again, we hear the parents say that they made a very tough decision, that it was the toughest decision they've ever made in their life, and it hurts me deeply because it ends up being about the parents. And for once, I just wish we can listen to the kids before we end up having to investigate another death.
We have just about a minute left here. Very briefly, Megan, what legislation or reform do you support to improve the industry you represent?
Okay, well, there's quite a few things out there. And since Sarah Gelser's on the line, I'm going to point out that I actually like many of the Oregon regulations. In particular, I like the communication provision that they have. I think it's very well written and encompassing. It contains language about the court orders and how that might impact communication, and that's something I think is missing in some of the legislation that's being introduced in Utah this year. I like that the client's involved in the creation of their treatment service plan. In many places, they're involved in maybe updates or changes to the plan, but not the creation, and I think that's very interesting. I like how that's set up. I want to quickly go back.
We've only got about 10 seconds here before we're going to have to wrap it.
So
if you can do it briefly.
Okay, I just wanted to point out with the funding of the research, with the transport, let's focus on that. I want to fundamentally change the transport industry. I want it to be more of an intervention model, none of the 2 a.m. wake-ups. It should be in daylight with family and siblings and people who love that child in that room, and they have to go willingly. That's where I'm at.
And Senator Gelser, just in these final seconds, what would be most helpful to you at the federal level to help support the work you're trying to do in your state?
I think the elimination of religious exemptions and ensuring that no congregate care program can take in a child unless it's licensed.
That's Sarah Gelser. She's a Democrat in the Oregon State Senate. Also with us today, Kenneth Rosen. He's a senior editor and correspondent at Newsweek and the author of the new book, Troubled, The Failed Promise of America's Behavioral Treatment Programs. Also with us, Megan Stokes, the executive director of the National Association of Therapeutic Schools and Programs. Thanks to you all. And we've been hearing from you during this hour. Isaac emailed, I'm a social worker who briefly worked in a residential program in Rochester, New York in 2016. I didn't last more than 7 months. I quickly felt like nothing more than a cog in the criminal justice machine, and the program primarily housed teens of color from poor households. It was also glaringly clear that the agency I worked for cared more about keeping the beds full than doing authentic therapeutic work with the teens and their families. I'm sure this is a subject we will return to here on 1A. Today's producer was Avery Kleinman. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.